Hello, and welcome to this audio edition of Philip Huscher's program notes for upcoming concerts by the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. I'm Rich Caparella. Concerts by the CSO on Thursday, May 23rd through Saturday, the 25th, feature guest conductor Naimi Järvi with soprano Marie Eriksman, mezzo-soprano Karen Cargo, and the Chicago Symphony Chorus. The program is but one work, The Resurrection Symphony No. 2 by Gustav Mahler. And here are Philip Huscher's program notes on the Mahler Resurrection Symphony, a work lasting about 90 minutes. Early in 1888, Gustav Mahler dreamed that he was lying on a funeral bier surrounded by flowers. That spring, he started a symphony that begins with a funeral march. This would mark his introduction to the great symphonic tradition, and at the top of his manuscript, he wrote Symphony in C Minor, First Movement. Mahler intended this as a breakaway work, his first departure from the world of the symphonic poem, popularized by Liszt, Dvorak, and Tchaikovsky, among others, and was being rejuvenated at that very time by the young Richard Strauss. Mahler himself had just completed a big symphonic poem in two parts, and although this is the work we now know as his first symphony, Mahler did not see it that way. Throughout the summer of 1888, Mahler worked at lightning speed, almost without interruption, on a vast movement in sonata form, that most classical of musical structures, and in the same key as the funeral march from Beethoven's Eroica Symphony. He completed the score on September 10th after only 6 months of steady work. But once he had finished this monumental first chapter, Mahler didn't know how to continue and wrote nothing for the planned symphony for another 5 years. He busied himself with composing songs to Des Knaben Wunderhorn text instead. At some point, Mahler began to doubt that he would ever finish the symphony. He had no clear idea of what shape the work should take, and he started to think of the funeral march movement as an independent piece. Eventually, he crossed out his original title and wrote the word Totenfeier, funeral rite, at the top of the manuscript. As early as 1891, when he wrote to Dr. Ludwig Strecker, head of the publishing house B. Schott, he referred to Totenfeier as a symphonic poem. That same year, he played through the piece at the piano for the influential conductor Hans von Bülow, who held his hands to his ears from time to time during Mahler's performance and stunned him afterwards by saying, "If that's music, then I know nothing about music." By 1893, Mahler was determined to produce a symphony. In January, he revised his earlier two-part symphonic poem and decided to call it his first symphony. That summer, he turned his attention to Totenfeier and wrote two new movements to go with it, an Andante and a Scherzo, the beginnings of a second symphony. But he was already worried that no final movement could ever balance the epic scale of the opening one. Ironically, it was at Bülow's funeral in February 1894 that Mahler heard Klopstock's Resurrection Ode and immediately envisioned a grand choral finale as a counterweight to the movement Bülow had so disliked. The rest of the symphony now came together quickly. That spring, he revised the first movement for a while it kept the Totenfeier title and sketched the last. In July, after deciding to add one of his Des Knaben Wunderhorn songs as an extra movement to set the stage for the finale, Mahler wrote to Richard Strauss that he had at last finished the Second Symphony, a work he now called The Resurrection after its concluding Klopstock verses. Mahler assured Strauss that the new symphony marked a giant step beyond his first, as a man to an infant, is how he put it. "There are, after all, 7 years between them," he continued. "That means something at our age." The two composers had recently become close friends, each recognizing but not always understanding the importance of the other's work. Mahler once said that he and Strauss were tunneling from opposite sides of the same mountain and might eventually meet in the middle. The following spring, Strauss planned to conduct the first three movements of Mahler's new five-movement symphony with the Berlin Philharmonic. Mahler got nervous. He wrote to Strauss reminding him that the score demanded a lot of extra instruments and later asked for an additional rehearsal. He even offered to pay for it. At the last minute, Strauss decided to let Mahler lead the work himself. And although Mahler agreed, he was still under contract to conduct the Hamburg Opera, and so he had to travel to Berlin each night after the opera and then return to Hamburg after rehearsing the symphony the next day. The performance, on March 4th, went well enough, although the hall was half empty and the reviews were mostly negative. How paralyzing it is, this continual tilting at windmills, Mahler said. But he went ahead, unfazed, with plans for the premiere of the complete symphony in Berlin in December. Mahler hoped that this would mark a turning point in his career, and he wrote to several established composers urging them to come. He told Strauss that there is no one in the world that I would rather have in my audience. As it turned out, Strauss was unable to attend. The performance, on December 13th, was Mahler's first real public sensation as a composer. The young conductor, Bruno Walter, attended the concert and was stunned both by the brilliance of the score and by the audience's hostility, misunderstanding, belittlement, scorn, words that would follow Mahler's music for many years. Yet, he concluded, the work left such a deep impression of greatness and originality, of the force of Mahler's personality, that one may date his rise to fame as a composer from that day. Conceived as the opening of a symphony and later marketed as a tone poem, the first movement is one of Mahler's most ambitious creations, a large-scale sonata form that encompasses music of tragedy and triumph, vehemence and lyricism. Erupting from a single ominous tremolo, it marches forward through a landscape of dramatic shifts in mood, dynamics, and tempo. At its center is one of those great Mahlerian climaxes during which so much happens that, for a moment, our sense of time seems strangely altered. Aside from some judicious editing and a beefed-up orchestration, the movement is practically the same as the original Totenfeier. Mahler once said that this music asks the great question, why did you live? Why did you suffer? Is it all nothing but a huge, cruel jest? At the very end of the movement, when the trumpet in a piercing wail falls from E natural to E flat, turning C major into C minor, Mahler seems to suggest an answer. The next three movements are all shorter and more lightly scored. Mahler once referred to them as an interludium. In fact, he worried that the shift from the heavy drama of the first movement to the gentle andante that follows was too great, and at the last minute scribbled a line in the copyist's score suggesting a pause of at least 5 minutes between the two movements, a request that few conductors, apparently including Mahler himself, have taken at face value. The andante does at first seem to come from another world. This is Mahler's vision of the Landler, an Austrian folk dance of grace and a certain melancholy charm. Mahler described this music as a mournful melody of youth and lost innocence, and on the surface it is the lightest and least complicated movement in the symphony. In fact, at the Paris premiere in 1910, Debussy stormed out, dismissing it as reactionary and too Schubertian. Yet for all its apparent simplicity, this Landler is meticulously crafted and very carefully detailed. Mahler offers the conductor four suggestions in two languages, andante moderato, sehr gemächlich, very gently, nie eilen, do not hurry, grazioso, before the first note even sounds. The third movement, a bitter, slithering scherzo, is a symphonic expansion of Mahler's Knabenwunderhorn song about St. Anthony of Padua's Sermon to the Fishes. They listened to the sermon, the original song goes. They liked the sermon, and they remain like everyone else. The crabs still go backward, the cod stay stupid, the carp still gorge themselves. They forgot the sermon, they liked the sermon, and they remain like everyone else. It's this music, with its peacefully flowing undercurrent, that runs throughout the notorious third movement of Luciano Berio's Sinfonia, providing a blackboard on which Berio scribbles his own salacious graffiti. The fourth movement opens unexpectedly with the sound of the human voice alone, at first, singing another Wunderhorn song, Urlicht, Primal Light. Scored for a woman's low voice and lightly accompanied, this is music of quiet depth and hymn-like simplicity. It's surprising to discover Mahler writes 22 changes of meter in the first 36 measures. The calm of Urlicht is shattered by a great cry of despair from the orchestra. In a wild outburst, Mahler tells the conductor, not unlike the chaos with which Beethoven begins his choral finale in the Ninth Symphony. Horns sound from the distance, the crier in the wilderness, in Mahler's words, and gradually and mysteriously, Mahler knits a large fabric of seemingly disparate materials, a fanfare, a chorale, a broad and raucous march. After a great eruption, marking most exactly the midway point in the movement, there is a benign calm and finally total stillness, an extraordinary passage in which four trumpets, each sounding from a different direction behind the scenes, join offstage horns together with the onstage flute and piccolo over distant thunder. Time seems to stand still, and it's only with the unexpected, hushed entry of the chorus singing Klopstock's resurrection hymn, an unforgettable moment in a symphony filled with bold, theatrical strokes, that Mahler begins to move forward toward his final destination. Gradually, a few instruments join the voices. How magically the solo soprano's line emerges and rises above them all, and the music slowly grows more confident and hopeful. The final choral stanza in the triumphant E-flat major, preordained by the symphony's C minor opening, is greeted with a rush of fanfares and pealing bells. One is battered to the ground, Mahler said after leading the premiere, and then raised on angel's wings to the highest heights. A parting word about Mahler's subject. Because of the opening funeral march and the final resurrection chorus, Mahler was regularly asked to tell the story behind this symphony, a task he already found tiresome in the 1890s, and one he would eventually resist altogether. In 1896, he said it was the hero of his first symphony who was laid to rest here. But in 1891, he offered a more general scenario. We stand by the coffin of a well-loved person, his life, struggles, passions, and aspirations once more for the last time pass before our mind's eye. Later, he described this explanation provided at the request of King Albert of Saxony as a crutch for a cripple. Mahler quickly grew tired of justifying his works by revealing their inner stories and wished that people would take them at face value. Ultimately, he said that this symphony, like all music, expresses precisely what words cannot. We find ourselves faced with an important question: how and indeed why music should be interpreted in words at all. As long as my experience can be summed up in words, I write no music about it. My need to express myself musically, symphonically, begins at the point where the dark feelings hold sway, at the door which leads into the other world, the world in which things are no longer separated by space and time. Words by the composer himself and program notes by Philip Huscher on Gustav Mahler's Symphony No. 2, Resurrection. I'm Rich Caparella. Thanks for listening.